Welcome to Whistleblower Network News. I am your host, Jane Turner, FBI whistleblower and advocate. It is our honor to share with you these experiences of real-life heroes and people of integrity. Today, we have part two with Ashley Jovic, and you heard her story about being terminated from Apple. It's an incredible story, and in part two here, we're going to talk about the retaliation she suffered, the ideals of whistleblowing, the misconceptions, and I want to point out this piece that Ashley wrote in Covert Action magazine. Little known publication to me, but it was a powerful piece, and we'll link it to this podcast, because it was powerful. And she did a lot of research. Of course, she has a lawyer's mind. Everything is laid out extremely well in this article. She mentions about the positive associations that go with whistleblowing individuals, such as they're known as educated, honest, they have a strength of character, they have spiritual faith. And as she says, these are subjective things. So we're going to talk about some of these ideals she put in this article because they're so fascinating. And the fact that a half of the workers at any company never even raise a concern. So, Ashley, welcome back. I'm so glad to see you. And this piece you wrote for Covert Action magazine, it's just drop dead right on point. Can you tell us what got you to amass this incredible research and write this article about whistleblowers?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm very quickly summarizing Apple's response and I'm leaving a lot out. It was a very holistic and passionate form of retaliation that continues to this day. And has disrupted just every aspect of my life. And has caused a lot of depression and PTSD. And I had kind of just felt stuck in that. I didn't really know what to call myself or where I fit in with the world anymore. And I didn't feel like I had the concepts or language to describe this pain I was feeling. So I'm a researcher. I sat down and I was like, I wonder if there's studies about this. I had seen Jacqueline Garrick's whistleblower retaliation checklist earlier on. I actually printed it out. It was like all just on my coffee table looking at it to like counter the gaslighting. There's like read her checklist. It's great. She goes through the categories of retaliation and how frequently they happen and how it impacts people. So I was like, I wonder if there's more. And there's a lot more. So I spent several months reading all these academic studies and research articles and then summarizing the findings. And for me, it was therapy personally to work through what happened, where I'm at, why I'm struggling. Like everything was well known and documented for decades. So when I was able to lay it out, it was healing for me and gave me kind of an ability to move forward. But I've had so many people reach out after reading it too. It sounds like it was something a lot of other people needed as well.
Oh, I was absolutely stunned by the clarity of your writing and the issues that you raised. One of the facts is like right now where you're saying, hey, I had PTSD. You know, whistleblowers in my time, which goes way back, would never admit that because it would, you know, say that they were weak or compromise the cause that they were trying to bring to the fore. But you seem to have no problem saying, hey, we're talking here about PTSD, depersonalization, incredibly important concepts and the reality of whistleblowers. So I was just overjoyed to see this in writing.
Well, and it's interesting, as you say that, it clicked for me the first time. I wonder if I've so recently become more open about it because I got my initial issues addressed. There is something really important in that for people who are trying to blow the whistle, because everything that happens later was all because you want to push that first thing forward. And so I think, you know, after I got the public records and the FOIA documents, and I can publicly say I was right, and it was good that I actually spoke up because they found even worse issues, it freed me a little bit from having to constantly defend my character and all of that, which most people are just stuck doing forever.
Oh, exactly. And I know whistleblowers right now are still fighting that, you know, the character assassination. But one of the things you brought up was that half of workers at a company never raise a concern. Others raise a concern, but give up after it proves futile, you know, that there's failed attempts to get some change, or they get a little pushback. And then you have this whistleblower who speaks out, even though it escalates. And that's where I think a lot of us found ourselves, you know, that we continued speaking out. And that's why I talk about the courage of whistleblowers, which always I find incredible, because they don't back down. They intend to go the full route. Yeah. You write about that.
I do, but also in a different way than most people have been talking about. Yes. I'm so glad you liked it, because it kind of, you know, I do think whistleblowers are brave for going forward, but also for a different reason. So yes. One of the things I was trying to find out, like, I had a response with whistleblower support groups being so lovely, like yourself, and encouraging and celebrating me as some like great human. And then you also have all the people who are doing like basically the Scientology squirrel busting, if you're not familiar. We're just like surrounded by people being like, you're the worst person that's ever existed. What are you? And like, so I'm like, who am I? What happened?
Yeah.
I'm wondering, like, did I do something wrong or better or whatever with, and so you get so spun up in, was there something about me? And if so, did I do good enough? Or was I bad? And then you just spin. So when I start digging, I start seeing references to business ethics textbooks and academia. And actually, for decades, the way that usually they look kind of clinically at whistleblowing from a business ethics standpoint is, it's not about the person at all. It's about what the issue is that someone's trying to bring forward. So they lay out a spectrum and a framework of when it is like acceptable to blow the whistle, and then when it's kind of like required to blow the whistle, and then this interesting spot in between. So, like, you know, when it's acceptable, you can't go around blowing the whistle on everything. Like, if I filed an NLRB charge every day for a year, they'd probably like sue me. You know, you can't do that. So it needs to be, and they generally say it's like some issue that's like systemic or could cause physical harm. You have evidence that it's occurring. You tried to push it through to your first level. It's not being addressed. Okay, so now you probably have the justification to push this a little bit higher. And then when you go to the, like, you know, you're kind of a terrible person if you don't blow the whistle. Mm-hmm. And this really spoke to me, because to me, I always felt like I had no choice. Like, it wasn't, right. I was just like, who wouldn't say, like, you're being exposed to carcinogenic chemicals, like someone else, you know? So it's right. You know of an imminent or ongoing threat to public good or physical safety or whatever. You have evidence on hand that, you know, a neutral person could look at your evidence and be like, you're right, we need to look into this. And you have a path forward. You can give that to someone who can help. And you had tried, you know, internally if it was feasible. Then it's kind of like, you kind of have to. And if you don't, like, there's questions about you, of like your empathy or ethics. But then there's this huge spot in between with this reckoning process. And this made a lot more sense to me than the subjective labels that we often attach to people, though they could impact some of it. So, okay, it's justified you can blow the whistle. It's not morally required. Then you're thinking about, what kind of resources do I have? Do I have enough savings that, like, if I was fired tomorrow, I'm not going to end up like immediately homeless? Mm-hmm. Do I have, you know, kids in school I need to pay, or I'm taking care of my parents, of mortgages? You know, you're going through that. You're going through your stat, like your standing. Am I respected? Will people listen to me? Do I have credibility with this? What kind of evidence do I have? So I really go into that process as they describe some of these factors that people, it'll be both kind of like, they'll look into themselves and their lives, but then they'll also kind of look into the issue and what evidence they have to decide, will I push it and how far will I push it? And I think that speaks a lot more to folks who maybe you could say like are just brave, you know. I think a lot of us who just felt morally obligated, like, I can't not do this. And I'm like, it's not bravery, and I wish I didn't have to. Like, if I could go back and somehow get them right. to stop doing it another way that didn't involve me ruining my life, I would prefer to do that.
Right.
So it's complicated. And I think it's also misleading for people who haven't had to blow the whistle yet to think that it's some kind of, like, you know, phenomenal person, superstar who would do such a thing. when like tomorrow they could be faced with a situation where they have the moral obligation now to raise an issue and they have the evidence and they're like, oh, you know, it can happen to anyone.
Yes. And so explain, in all this research you did, you know, why are, and you talked about subjective characteristics of whistleblowers, but what is the innate quality that gives a whistleblower that impetus to go ahead? Because so many fall by the wayside, or at the first pushback, boop, they're gone.
I think, so for me personally, and this wasn't yes. in the research, but I find this fascinating. I think it's more like the question is, who would be in that moral obligation territory?
Right.
That doesn't, and what is wrong with their brains? Like, it could be like that's the sociopaths and the antisocial, and or just very corrupt or greedy, or they're took part in some of this and they're implicated. So they want to cover up that they, you know, I think there's more, it'd be a more interesting inquiry of who does not speak up once the issue is that severe.
Right.
So urgent to push it forward. And this was like calming to me. Otherwise, there's no innate characteristic. It's just like what lands on your desk that it's up to you to try to push forward.
Right. But yeah. but it isn't everybody who pushes forward. It's yeah. it's a very small group of people. It's very small. So there's got to be something about that small group that allows them to do that. Did you come up with anything?
So actually, like, I discouraged that search. So, I mean, you can say that there are some that they've kind of like correlated, but most of it makes sense of like, you have some financial stability, you have some standing, you have the status that you think it'll help you, that you'll be successful in doing it. But when we're constantly searching for these answers, like, I like worry, I'm like, corporations are going to build like AI to like look for those people, and they're going to flag them and not hire them, or maybe good lawyers point. Are looking for those people to pick who like the best clients would be or whatever. Like, I don't think anything good comes of that data set.
Good point.
Great. Data
good point. You did say some figures that were astounding, such as 70% of whistleblowers will find themselves fired or forced to resign. That's a staggering number, 70%.
And I haven't seen as many studies on this, and I would be interested in this, but I think more of the characteristics of people is after they've blown the whistle and they start facing the retaliation, who's able to persevere. You know, there's that initial of like the initial blowing the whistle, of going to a regulator, of, you know, emailing the CEO, whatever it is. And for that, I think like that's more of just the subjective, like you're doing that reckoning process. But then once the retaliation unfolds,
yes.
you know, I think it depends a lot of factors on the person and their life and what they've gone through, what they're going through, of when they're going to say like, I give up. Because everyone says I give up at some point with this stuff. Like, there's never of like, oh, it's all fixed and everything's great and my life's back to normal, right? Like, so everyone's going to like tap out like wrestling wise. Like, they're going to be like, I'm done. But it's like, how far can they get? How much can they handle? Like, for me, I had a really rough childhood. I had a lot of abuse I dealt with that I was able to get through therapy. I've had PTSD I've dealt with. And I think that actually enabled me, unfortunately, to like get through this, because it's like, it feels like home. So messed up, but I was able to get those coping skills. I was able to
early on.
And I've talked to other people who say similar things, that, you know, they've gone through a really hard time with childhood or divorce, or they were in combat or something, where they had to build that resilience and perseverance, and kind of guided, you know, by the morals and values of why you're doing it, just to carry on. I think there's a lot of people who, if they haven't had any experience like that and they really had no idea what they're expecting, give up pretty early on. And I don't think we should blame them.
Like, oh no.
It's crazy what.
Yeah. Oh no.
Yeah.
Never blame. I would never blame a whistleblower who, like you said, tapped out. It's very difficult. I mean, we can't kid ourselves that it's easy. You did mention a whistleblower that you felt got by pretty easy, but yeah. you know, circumstances depends on a lot of things. Yeah.
Well, I think it's looking at the different types of whistleblowing. So we're talking more about a whistleblower that's been kind of a pundit. So they're talking about their policy issues and they're kind of set up already well connected. So when I wrote my article, I very, very narrowly defined whistleblower for the purpose of what I want to talk about, which was what I was saying. Like, you find something, the public's being harmed, only you can reveal it. So you keep escalating. And then like after that first escalation, it fails. You're like, I'm going to keep trying. And I focused on people doing that while they're still employed. And then like, you know, disaster unfolds. Cause that's, I think, a very unique experience that like someone who had already quit and then maybe reveal some stuff isn't going to have the same experience of the probably getting fired very quickly.
Right. Right. And you did experience the techniques that have been explained here over the last 10 years about mobbing, gaslighting, identity disruption. You know, before, here again, I go back 25 years, but there was never any, you know, description or terms like that. You just suffered and you didn't know why. But you have put these terms there, which make a lot of sense. This mobbing, gaslighting, identity disruption. Did all those things happen to you? And is that usually? I'm sorry.
You know, and I want to give, I mean, what I did was a summary. And that's kind of, that's one of my favorite type of research is to go in and read just like, you know, hundreds, thousands of pages and then have a summary that doesn't exist of all of that other research. And so I hadn't seen a summary like this before and I wanted to do that. So credit to everyone who did that original research. I footnote them all, go read those studies too.
Yes.
Yeah, but
a lot has come out in 10 years, 15, 20 years, Ashley.
It's
really interesting, a lot of research. So let me ask you, why do you think that after all this, all these years and all this research, it's retaliation is just as functional and as powerful as years ago? Is it because it's successful?
It's so successful. It's like phenomenally successful, you know, and that was one of the things, seeing the frequency of this and these stories of just like, it's like clockwork of, you know, they're going to do all this and then you're going to end up homeless and bankrupt and working at Radio Shack and enjoy your new life. You know, like it's, there's a very predictable playbook. And I spent some time also in some research about the power dynamics with these companies, why they retaliate. I didn't want to just look at the retaliation and the person like experiencing it, but I also want to understand because of the things like mobbing. So when all of a sudden your coworkers, or like I said, the squirrel busting, where they're all just like, you're the worst person, you betrayed us. And you're just like, so why are they doing that? What caused them to do that?
Right.
And there's some good explanations of like, if they are benefiting from the system that's in place and what you're exposing is a systemic issue, that if it was addressed, they would lose their status in that existing system, even though it's problematic. They're going to defend it. If their part of their identity is defined by what they do and the group they work in and their position at work, if you exposing something could potentially disrupt that, and how they define themselves, they're going to try to like push back too. Like there's a long list of psychological reasons that make a lot of sense, sociological, of why sometimes it's just like an inherent pushback. And some of the worst of it will come from people who are complicit. So anyone that's complicit in the malfeasance that's being exposed wants to cover it up, wants to minimize what they did. And the easiest way to do that is to discredit the whistleblower, get them out of sight so they don't even have to think about it. Because then they're also dealing with their own cognitive dissonance issues of this person's highlighting this stuff that does seem like immoral, unethical, unlawful. I'm involved, but I'm also getting a lot of pay and I have the job security and I got to pay my mortgage and how do I make? So then they just like attack the whistleblower.
Yes.
Yeah.
Brutally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you also, it extended, reminded me of Sharon Watkins. It extended beyond your employment. She, to this day, is still getting negative feedback, people trying to disrupt her life. And you are having the same kind of phenomenon. They broke into your house. Isn't that right?
After you talked about that on the break a couple times. They installed like surveillance equipment. They mailed me like a bugged object from my desk. You know, just crazy stuff. And they had like PIs that were showing up in my house to intimidate me. And I had calls from blocked numbers and threatening emails and threatening social media stuff and spies, people that would reach out pretending to be a friend who are actually spying or trying to like they were doing the FBI stuff a lot. So as you know that, like, okay, now these companies have the ex-FBI agents. Now they're using them for the FBI things.
Yeah, and let's talk about that, because let's talk about that cozy relationship between corporate America and our leading intelligence agencies. Let's talk about that. You discovered that where you lived while you were working in California, that they had an extremely cozy relationship with the FBI. Tell us why.
Yeah. So as some of this stuff is happening, you know, I'm hesitant to report to the police officers immediately, because there had just been news that the head, like the chief compliance officer at Apple, was indicted for bribing the local sheriff.
Yes.
And somehow he got unindicted, and we don't know how, which is the headline. So like, I'm like, I don't want to call the police. They apparently work for Apple. But I thought, like, reporting the FBI with some of the stuff that was going on, like threats. One of the online accounts was threatening them when Apple mailed me my possessions to my desk, which include a bugged object, that it was actually the severed head of one of my loved ones.
Oh.
That movie Seven, they did this whole, and they found out Apple. And so, like, I'm reporting this stuff, and, like, when I talk to the FBI case people on the phone, they're like, what? You know, there's a response, but I never hear back. I never hear anything. And so I'm like, part of everything that's been going on, so I have the initial issues, I have the retaliation, I have what appears to be systemic corruption, I have government capture. I keep trying to research and dig and share what I find, and a lot of people are following along because they've either had a similar experience or, like, it's just illuminating to see someone go through this. And so I'm like, okay, what's Apple's relationship with the FBI, other than, like, the famous, like, San Bernardino thing where they were supposedly fighting the FBI? But even, like, when you read deeper in that, Apple was like, we'll give you all the iCloud data, FBI. It's more data than you probably need. Happy to give it to you any moment you want, right? So there's still, and then I find an article with the San Francisco regional office of the FBI from only a few years prior, where their, like, bureau chief is saying that they love Apple, is like the headline, that Apple trains their cops. Apple, like, helps them so much with the technology. And they said something like Apple's the victim and they like protecting Apple. So I'm like, they're not going to help. Like, and so of course, Apple's doing this crazy stuff that they're probably hoping that I won't even tell people, because it sounds crazy. And I had to make that decision of whether I'd even tell people. And I'm like, let's just.
Right.
Because it sounds insane.
Right. Because they simply say, well, she's crazy. You know, that's the old time nuts and sluts defense. By
either you want attention or you're out of your mind. Or
both. Yeah, exactly. But I have seen it myself, so I'm here to tell you that you're onto something, because I've seen it myself. When the FBI needs the cooperation, take, for an example, somebody like Apple, that they need them to crack codes, you know, to retrieve evidence, sometimes in extremely high-level cases, you know, they're not going to bite the hand that feeds them. It's just not going to happen.
Well, NSA, too, they need to understand the technology.
Right.
They are spying on people.
Right.
So, like, they need training and they need to know what new software updates are coming out and stuff.
That's right.
Need a working relationship. And that's a valid request, right? Here's the problem.
Right.
It's like a giant monopoly that's in charge of everything and has so much power and so much money that if it also captures the law enforcement agencies, now
you're in trouble.
Like East India Company.
Exactly. You're in trouble. But I'm here to tell you, you're not paranoid. You're not delusional. You're on to it. It happens. It's real. And you know that also.
Yeah.
So
I got a video of like the RF signals coming out of the little statue for my desk and like all of that. So I was like, someone.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, I think that also it traumatizes whistleblowers through this retaliation process, because the stuff they'll do is just deranged sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it's hard for you to even admit that it happens. I've been practicing talking about the break-in now for almost like a year, and I can finally almost say it without having to like take a minute to like brace myself.
Right. Because you don't want to come across as crazy or paranoid, but it does happen.
And it's traumatic. So I found this statue was bugged, and I was like, because I live tweet everything that happens also for personal security, which I've said openly of like, if Apple were to like assassinate me, people would be like, why isn't Ashley tweeting? What was her last tweet about you? I'm laughing, but I'm crying. So I'm like tweeting that I find the bug statue and here's the video and it's coming back with all the stuff. And I was being hacked. My network was being hacked. And I got the logs on that. And then like at midnight, someone was trying to break into my apartment, I assumed to get the bugged object back because I said I was going to give it to like police or FBI the next day. So some, it's just like, it's exhausting. It's super traumatic. Like even if it was just like a normal break-in and you're at home and hear it, you can have PTSD from that, let alone if it's like your Apple computer employer.
Right, right. Well, so, you're, I'm telling you, Ashley, you're in good company. This has happened to other whistleblowers, as you know. In fact, Sharon was telling me about, they keep messing with her Wikipedia.
And then like now it has this special protection where like the accounts have to have like 500 entries before they can do it. But I'm like, they're just waiting for their moment now.
Mm-hmm. So you're in good company. It's happening to others. So you're not crazy. You're not paranoid. It happens to whistleblowers. And, you know, back then we used to talk within a very limited group about, because we didn't have that many 25 years ago, but we used to talk about whether there's an actual book out there that tells them how to retaliate against whistleblowers, because it was always the same, you know, kind of actions taken.
And like they have it for union busting. Well, I'm sure they have it for
right, right. Yeah. But when you did tell the FBI this stuff about what was happening, the bugged object, they did nothing. You haven't heard from them at all?
I haven't, and I'll do some of like the written reports and updates, and I'll call, and I'll be like, they'll be like, oh, we're adding it to your case file. And I'm like, so I have a case file, and they're like, we cannot confirm or deny. We gotta go. And they've like, I haven't heard anything from them. I am like hoping maybe they're secretly like investigating, because they wouldn't tell me if they were like really investigating. But I don't think they are, because Apple keeps doing all this stuff. Like one would think that Apple would be smart enough to stop. And they stopped a little bit because I decided as they kept doing this stuff, I was going to keep filing charges so this is one thing I wanted to call out in that whistleblower article too. And this is something I hadn't been able to like materialize until then, is whistleblowers will often have like a primary campaign and then a secondary and then even a tertiary. So the primary is like what you were trying to blow the whistle on in the first place. Your secondary is if you decide to like blow the whistle on the retaliation and file retaliation charges with the government. And then often the tertiary is once the government starts retaliating against you too, then you're also like trying to out the government and escalate the OSC to whatever the IG agency is. So there's a lot, and then you can kind of, you have to choose and you can't do all of it. And it's crazy.
You're absolutely right. So then
I was going to file charges every time they did this crap. And like, it sounds like their day of reckoning is coming soon. That's the NLRB case. It's been going like 2 years. Apparently it's been sitting with general counsel's office for like a year with them, like going through everything. And they're like, hold on. So like, they can't tell me that there's merit, but they would have dismissed by now if there wasn't. So I'm hoping they're going to like call them out on a lot of this stuff. I think a lot of people won't bring it up because it's embarrassing or it's just too much information or whatever. But I'm like, I want them to have to answer for all of this crap.
And I agree with you. I hope it works out that way, Ashley. I really do. I think you're a potent voice in the whistleblower universe. I hope that you'll join us for National Whistleblower Day on July 27th in some capacity. I know you're in a location which is not disclosable because of what Apple has done to you. Yeah. But I hope that you will become a great part to the whistleblower community. You've established this website. Can you tell us about it?
So I have a whistleblower website, ashleyjovic.com, where I've detailed all my cases and I have some of the filings people can look at. And I have like the Twitter posts from that period where I was removed from the workplace. And a lot of resources just to get up to speed. It has links to my social media. If you want to follow the like true crime podcast, that is just my Twitter feed at this point. Yes. I have a consulting website, jovic.co, where I have the DNG Center. The DNG Center right now has been mostly focused on advocacy on things that come up that aren't part of my like core part of my lawsuits, but stuff that I want to reform. I see these issues, systemic issues with these corporations. One of them ended up being the reason Apple claims it fired me. It's like, it's not because she reported us to the feds and they raided us and found issues. It's because, and the two things they chose was one, me tweeting, complaining that they emailed me 3 times while I was suspended, asking to 3D scan my ears and my ear canals. And I complained on Twitter that it was like I did not want that and they should stop. And then the other one was I talked to a journalist who was writing an article, Apple cares about privacy unless you work at Apple, and disclosed this app they were using on our phones to train data for Face ID, but it was taking pictures of us, like basically videos, a bunch of pictures, and gathering our biometrics whenever the phone thought it saw a face. And they wanted R&D employees on like one phone for work and personal. So it's taking pictures of me in the bathroom, in the bedroom, naked. It's taking pictures of people around me, gathering everyone's biometrics. And so I wanted to bring that up of like, I don't want this on my phone.
No.
It's crazy Apple does this. So they said they fired me because I told people they wanted to scan my ear canals and that they were taking naked pictures of me. So like part of my lawsuit is me saying like, that's not a legitimate business justification.
No.
And like, you just admitted to more crimes. So like, let's let the government deal with that. But I also, you know, they do this stuff in a lot of their offices, they do it globally. And looking into it, it was an area that has not really been approached yet, is companies like Apple, Google, Facebook doing all these weird studies on their employees. So they should be going and like paying and getting like lawful data with appropriate consent agreements. But instead, they're using their workforce to do the stuff for them. And in Europe, GDPR says you can't do that. The employment relationship is inherently coercive. So an employee can't consent to doing this stuff. So like, don't even ask them. So I took Apple's letter saying this is why we fired her. And I filed it to a number of European governments.
Good.
The UK, Ireland, Germany's still investigating. There's a Face ID lab there. I think they're going to take action. I've sent it to other federal agencies. It sounds like FTC is looking into it now and working with NLRB on it. So I'm trying to find stuff as I'm going through this that's not core to my case, but seems like something that's like worthy of trying to get addressed. And for certain projects, I have some people helping and advising and trying to push this stuff through. Right now, it's like not, it's just more work. I'm not making any money off of it, but I think it's important as we're having these conversations to bring up these things that don't usually come up. Like Apple wants to 3D scan my ear canals and says they'll fire me if I tell anyone. Seems like something that people should be looking at.
And since you brought that up, I want to mention, like most whistleblowers, you're on the edge of being evicted because here they've totally ruined your reputation and any chances to get another job. This is very typical in the whistleblowing world. Do you have some funds set up that people can contribute to?
Yeah, so my lease is about to be up in a couple of months, and I have now used up my entire life savings and cannot get a job. So when that's up and I have to move out, I'm not going to be able to get a new apartment because I have no income or way to pay rent. That's great. I do have a GoFundMe, and then I have other donation options also mentioned on my website. Appreciate any support. It's remarkable how quickly and predictably you lose like your life savings doing
everything,
When your name's made public, especially when there's any way to like Google your name and it comes up that you're doing something like this, like you're just not getting another job. You're denying listed by the fact that you spoke up in the first place, especially about a really powerful company. And I was in a position where I knew that I would like not be broke the next day, but like it's now.
Oh, Ashley, I'm so sorry. But
also, if anyone's hiring.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, to somebody who's incredibly intelligent, photogenic, and just has an incredible story. Thank you, Ashley. You are something. You are an inspiration. Thank you so much for spending time with Whistleblower of the Week. We appreciate you and look forward to working with you for Whistleblower events.
Love that. Thank you so much, Jane. Thank you for all the work you do.
Thank you.
Hello. My name is Sharon Watkins. For better or worse, I am known as the Enron whistleblower, and I certainly have a heart for those going through anything that can be called blowing the whistle or speaking truth to power. I am here today to encourage every one of you to participate in making National Whistleblower Day permanent. You can do this by going to www.whistleblowersblog.org. and joining notable whistleblowers like Jane Turner, Bunny Greenhouse, Aaron Restwick, Fred Whitehurst, and myself in taking action. We are urging our representatives, and you can too, urge your representatives and President Biden to sign an executive order recognizing whistleblowers on a permanent National Whistleblower Day. Again, that's www.whistleblowersblog.org. Together we can make this happen.
Thank you for listening, and please don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe. If you want to read more whistleblower stories, go to www.whistleblowersblog.org. Music by Rachel Kilgore. Editing and booking by Anissa Sheikh and Victoria Thompson. And a special thanks to our sponsors, Whistleblower Network News. It's just as hard to stand up tall as it was when you were small. The truth is hard to say.